Good afternoon. It's a great relief to see that you've all come back. But the speaker's dread is to find that everybody's run away after lunch. Though you know there was a cabinet minister who was addressing Parliament across the road at the beginning of the last century, and he said that he'd had a dream. He dreamt that he was addressing Parliament and woke up to find that he was doing so. So if any of you want to have a little snooze, that's perfectly fine. Please try not to snore. I would like to say something now about resting. Resting, taking Sabbath, being at peace in God. Westminster Abbey, St. Margaret's Church, is surrounded by great busyness. The busyness of government, of Parliament, the busyness of commerce. Everybody is running around at great speed. And one reason why many people come to our churches, particularly perhaps St. Margaret's here, is to be quiet, is to have a moment of tranquility. And often in our society, the assumption is that we rest so as we can go back to work. We rest at the weekend so that we'll be strong enough to get back to the grindstone on Monday morning. Even retired people feel this pressure to work. But Joseph Pieper argued that in the classical world it was the other way around. The Greek word for work, ascholia, means not to be at leisure. Just as the Latin word, negotium, means negotium, not at leisure. So in the classical world, the ordinary state of being human is to be at leisure, at peace. But sometimes we have to work so as to do this. This is, incidentally, why I love Jane Austen. Because in her novels, nobody ever seems to be doing any work at all. But in the Bible, leisure is even more extraordinary. For the peoples around Israel, the neighboring countries, they thought that the gods made human beings so that the gods may party, party, party. The gods lolled on their couches and drank their wine while human beings were created to be slaves, to keep the fires and the libations going and the sacrifices. So to be human was to work, but to be divine was to rest. But the God of Israel did something absolutely extraordinary. He invited us human beings to share his rest. This is scandalous. It's as if Lord Grantham in Downton Abbey were to say to the butler, "Now come along, old chap, have a glass of port with us." It was completely breaking all the conventions. Resting for us is sharing the divine life, living with God's own life. That's why we rest on the Lord's Day, or we should anyway. And the great redemptive act, of course, is the Exodus, which is the liberation from work. Moses is told that the people must go into the wilderness so that they may worship God. But because the Pharaoh spots what it's all about, he says, "Why are you taking the people away from their work? Get back to your labor. They're lazy. That's why they cried, 'Let us go and worship.' Let heavier work be laid on them, that they will labor at it and pay no attention to these deceptive words. So in the world of Israel, labor was a form of slavery. So our destiny is to be liberated from the grind of work and have an eternal party with God. The Pharaoh is right. Our God wants to liberate us from the grind of work. Philip Larkin wrote, "Why should I let the toad work squat on my life?" Now, it's a bit complicated, because today, for many of us, because the old simple division of work and labor has broken down for a lot of people, perhaps particularly for luckier, more blessed people. Work isn't just from 9 to 5. If you are a parent, or if you're a writer, or many people work at home. So work is not easily separable always from leisure. When I sat down to prepare these notes rather hastily, I didn't say, "Oh, I must do some work. I must write about leisure for these people at Westminster." Because it's my delight, it's my joy to be able to prepare to preach and talk. So what then is the burden of labor? And I would say, as with the Israelites, it can be a form of violence, oppressive. The endless busyness can be a violence against the human life. Thomas Merton, the Cistercian monk, wrote, "The rush and pressure of modern life are the most common form of its innate violence. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit yourself to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything, is to succumb to violence." The Mahatma Gandhi refused to fly anywhere, not because of the carbon footprint, but because he thought that rapid transport was violent. One day, two American journalists came to see him, and they said, "Well, Mr. Gandhi, is it true that you object to flying by aeroplanes and all forms of rapid transport?" And Gandhi said, "It is true and it isn't true. Let me tell you." But he hadn't got any time, because they'd already left to catch the train. So when we come here for a day, it's mainly not to listen to the speaker. It's to be quiet, to rest, to take time off from the endless, relentless busyness, the hectic pace. I'm really impressed to see that remarkably few of you have been consulting your iPhones during these talks. Perhaps they're all at the back there. I remember when I was in Paris as a Dominican student, there was a famous art historian in the community called Le Père Régamé. And one day he came into the community room and he said, "Ever since I began to study yoga, I'm calm, I'm calm." It's good to distinguish between the objective busyness that many have to cope with and the subjective need to be busy, which is also a pressure on many people. When I arrived in Rome, after I was elected Master of the Order in 1992, I was astonished. I was completely unprepared for the sheer quantity of stuff to be done, people to meet, meetings to preside at, hundreds of letters to sign every evening in 4 different languages. It was such a pressure that I have to confess that at one stage I considered resigning. I'm just not up to it. And then I discovered the secret, which is I needed more time of silent prayer. We have a saying in religious life that everybody should have half an hour of silent prayer a day, unless they're very, very busy, in which case they should have an hour. Pope Francis, you know, takes 3 hours a day of silent prayer, and he has other things to do. When Pope John the 23rd went to bed at night, he always used to say, "All right, God, I've got to get a break. Now you take over and run the church for a little while." So there's that objective pressure of busyness. And I would say, in my experience, limited experience, it is precisely when you're most under pressure that you must make most time to be quiet. But secondly, there is the subjective pressure to be busy. The feeling that unless you are busy, you have no value. This time last year, I was in Iraq with our Dominican sisters. And they explained to me that in Iraq, as women, they have to be seen to be busy all the time if anybody is going to take them seriously. If they were seen to take leisure, then people would think that they didn't matter. But we believe that eternal life, rest in God, is a gift. You don't have to merit it. You can't merit it. You can't earn it. And so sometimes the best way that we preach as Christians, the best way we testify to our faith, is by doing nothing and by being seen to do nothing, by being unashamed to take time off. Holidays are holy days. There was a Dominican student when I was a young friar. We used to call him the eschatological symbol because he was never seen to do anything. Now, I admit I find it very hard, even when I had a sabbatical, the one sabbatical I've had in my life for 5 months, I worked intensely hard. I've mastered the art of flicking Free Cell off my computer screen the moment that anybody walks in, so that they find next Sunday's sermon up. When Vincent de Canongle, who was a master of the order in the 80s, when he came on visitation of the community, we really tried to impress him by how extremely hard we worked, how stretched we were, and we sat back complacently waiting for praise. And he said, "Well, you all work too hard. There's only one saviour of the world, and that's none of you." It's too late to say that we didn't actually really work quite so hard. We had a wonderful provincial in the English province 100 years ago called Bede Jarrett. Bede was a famous preacher, retreat giver. He wrote dozens of books. He was busy all over the world, but when you went to see Bede, he was never doing anything. He always looked as if all he was doing was for you to come in and sit down and talk to him. And we could never understand, well, I obviously wasn't born then, but the brethren could never understand how he did it. And when he died, they discovered that he wrote all his books in a drawer. So the moment anybody came in, it disappeared from sight. So at the heart of our Christian life should be a certain tranquility, a peace which the world cannot give. I learnt about this very early on in my Dominican life. Back in the late 60s, when I was a very young friar, we had a bomb attack on Blackfriars. Some very right-wing organisation which disapproved of what we were up to, mainly anti-racialist legislation. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, two small bombs went off at the front of the house in St Giles in Oxford and blew in all the windows. Everybody, 30 friars, we all rushed down to the front. I'd always wondered what the brethren wore in bed. Ambulances turned up, the police came, everybody was there except the prior. So the youngest novice was dispatched up to see the prior, Fergus Carr, very distinguished theologian. He said, "Fergus, Fergus, the prior has been bombed." And Fergus said, "Oh, anybody dead?" "No." "Anybody wounded?" "No." Well, go away," he said. "Let me go back to sleep. We'll think about it in the morning." That was my first glimpse into the meaning of leadership. Okay, the church has been burnt down. The bursar has run away with all the money. One of the priests has had a sex change. No worries. Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. There was a wonderful 19th century Secretary of State in the Vatican called Cardinal Consalvi. And it was a time when Napoleon was running over the whole of Europe, destroying churches, mainly putting his horses in them. And this Monsignor rushed in and said, your Eminence, Napoleon is trying to destroy the church." And the Cardinal said, "Oh, don't worry, not even we have succeeded in doing that." So how do we rest? I will make two suggestions. First of all, we rest in the gaze of God. When you're with old friends, good friends, what matters more than the conversation? What matters more than the wine and the food? What is really most important in any friendship is that you rest in each other's gaze. You're safe in the gaze of people who love you. They look at you with kindness. They give you peace. And this is even more radically the case with God. In that slightly absurd translation of our Catholic first Eucharistic prayer, he looks upon us with a serene and kindly countenance. The great prayer of Israel was, "Let your face shine on us, and we shall be saved." And in Jesus, that gaze of God was made flesh and blood in a human person who looked kindly on little Zacchaeus up his tree, who saw the woman putting her mite, who saw the disciples and called them. Jesus' gaze is our rest. Rowan Williams, in his wonderful, complex, but really superb book, Lost Icons, says that the secret of looking at icons is to let them look at us. We rest in the gaze of the icon. As the perspective bears down upon the beholder's eye, the eye of the icon figure searches, engages. The skill of looking at icons, the discipline of reading them, is the strange skill of letting yourself be seen. That's why it is the Christian tradition to come into churches like this and to rest in the presence of statues and icons. The liberating gaze of God. Because God is the one with whom we have no rivalry. You can't be in rivalry with God. And so many of our relationships have little items, edges of rivalry. He can't take away our breath. He is our breath. You can't bargain with God. So God is the one in whose eyes we dare to be naked. The nakedness of early baptism was an expression of that trust that in the presence of God, we don't need our clothes. Gregory of Nyssa said, "Casting off these fading leaves which veil our lives, we should once again present ourselves naked before the eyes of our Maker." There was an old Eastern prayer, "Unveil our eyes, give us confidence. Do not let us be ashamed or embarrassed. Do not let us despise ourselves." So much of what we do in coming to church is a sort of divine sunbathing, letting the radiance of God play on us. My order is relatively poor. And so when I was a young friar, we never were given any money to hitchhike. We always had to hitchhike everywhere. I know it's not very easy to do that these days. And once I had to hitchhike to Munich. And on the way, I stayed in an old house. And there was this great four-poster. And on the ceiling of the four-poster was this enormous eye of God looking at me. I had a sleepless night. I kept thinking, "Oh Lord, he knows all my secrets." I hadn't learned then, of course, that his is the eye which is completely accepting, which sees everything. So I think every Christian has a ministry, whether you ever preach or not. Every one of us has the ministry of mediating God's face, being the accepting, trusting, welcoming face of God. I had an extraordinary experience in Algeria, I don't know, 2 years ago. I had to go to the south of the country. It was part of an exploration of the state of the church and what the future of the church might be in Algeria. We had an uncomfortable middle of the day when my driver was a bishop of Oran, always have a bishop as your driver, and we were very nearly kidnapped, but that's another story. In the evening, we found ourselves in the northern Sahara. We had to get to the west, to a little community called El Abiod, and we couldn't see how to get there. And in a typical oasis, wonderful place of springs and palm trees, we asked a young father with his two sons, "Can we get to El Abiod that way?" And he looked at our car, which had got a bit bruised in the conflict earlier in the day, and he said, "Not in that car." We couldn't see any other way, so we tried. We drove through the desert, and finally the road ran out, and we couldn't go forward, and night was falling. It's very cold in the Sahara at night. And then we saw that he and his sons had followed us. So we got out of the car, and he said, "I haven't got any Arabic." He said in Arabic, "I told you so. Come and stay with us." And this will sound a little bit crazy, but it was as if in the desert, in the Sahara, in the face of three Muslims, it's as if I'd seen the face of God. I'd been looked at with all I could remember their faces perfectly. And secondly and lastly, I think we are quiet so that we may hear God speak to us. So many of our prayers are us speaking to God, which is fine. But it's only half of prayer. The other half is quietly waiting for God to speak to us in silence. St. John of the Cross said, the Father spoke one word, which was his Son. And this word he always speaks in eternal silence. And in silence, it must be heard by the soul. What happens when you sit in silence and listen for God? Unless you're a saint, or maybe got some mental difficulties, it's unlikely that you hear him say anything. God didn't say to me, get thee to Westminster and preach to those people. Tell them to keep quiet. I think it's about descending into a sort of depth within yourself where God is always. As St. Augustine said, closer to me than I am to myself. Listening to God, if this makes any sense, listening to God isn't expecting him to say anything. It's more that he speaks you and me into existence. Attending to God is attending somehow to the way that you are spoken into being, if that makes any sense, into who you are, so that you can shed all the false selves. Pope John Paul II, in this moment we hear God calling us to be, to live. We hear the word addressed uniquely to each of us. Each creature expresses and is called to express an aspect of the thought of God. There he finds his name and his identity. Most of the time we sit in silence. Nothing much happens. You think about what's going to be for breakfast or lunch, who you're going to see. I'm terribly distracted. Old Abbot Bernard Ampleforth used to say, anybody who thinks they pray, really pray, for more than 3 minutes a day is completely fooling themselves. But if we wait, occasionally the veil lifts and you glimpse the joy of God, the joy of God in each of us, and the joy that we have in God. And then we know him.